Welcome to the Secrets of the Lac du Salut Trail podcast. Hear from Chris Stowers and Danny Wenchikoy on the behind-the-scenes experience of making the documentary.
Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Stowers.
Hello, everyone. I'm Danny Wenchikoy. I'm the radio host and the travel writer in Taiwan.
In today's episode, we'll focus on the nature that we encountered during our walk along the Lac du Salut Trail.
Lac du Salut Trail. Yes.
Thanks for pointing that out, Dan.
Oh, yeah, definitely you have to, because a lot of people might be misunderstanding that. What is Lac du Salut?
Yes, because it's written in English as Lacnus.
Right.
So, and if you say that to people, they don't often understand what you're talking about.
Not at all,
Not many people recognize this trail.
Right, so that's why we have to specifically say it again, Lac du Salut.
Lac du Salut.
Yes, they're based on from the two different languages combining
tribes,
together.
Right?
Yes.
The indigenous people.
Lac du Salut, which means it's a camphor.
Camphor, the tree.
Yeah, Salut. In Hakka, which is a small rural trail.
Like a Shaolu in Chinese. So Seilu.
Right.
So you have to say it slowly. And in fact, as you walk the trail slowly, you say the trail slowly, syllable by syllable.
Lac du Salut.
That's a nice way of...
Yes, nice, right?
Yeah.
Fun fact, Lac du Salut is the term used by the Saisha and Daya tribes to refer to camphor tree. And Seilu means small path in the Hakka language.
Okay, so Chris, as you are the photographer, right?
So
what do you think about this time we have been doing this documentary? We've been to so many different kind of trail.
Okay, it's one trail, apparently. That's about 400 kilometers in total, but it starts or ends in Taoyuan County and goes down to Taichung County. So
right.
It depends which way you do it, and there are various routes that intertwine with each other, and other routes that come up from the lowlands into the hills, because this trail, system of trails, was used principally to export camphor wood, which is where it got its name from,
right.
And later on tea from the mountain areas down to be exported from the seaside,
right.
The coastal areas.
Mm-hmm.
So what you find, it wasn't exactly what I was expecting to find. The trail is quite jungly, but it's very varied. So the type of jungle varies. And sometimes within one section of the trail, you can go from thick vines and overhanging giant ferns, and suddenly you're in a bamboo forest, a bit like in Japan, you know. And the transition from one to the other is a bit disturbing.
Right.
Actually, normally this is because you're going over into a different microclimate. From one valley to another, or you're going up into the different tree levels, so you get different types of trees. So as a photographer, I don't usually do landscape photography or nature photography.
Okay.
No, I usually shoot people.
So this one for you, this time for you is kind of like a challenge, right?
Yeah, I'm not a walker either usually. Normally I cycle instead, but you couldn't cycle this trail, could you? It's too rough, it's too steep, it's too slippery. A lot of the time you're holding onto bamboo or vines just to keep your balance, and walking up these slippery stone staircases that people have reconstructed. But they're actually still reconstructing, aren't they?
Right.
A lot of the of the route. For me, the interest, along with the nature, was also arriving at isolated villages and townships along the way that still to this day, you would have trouble in finding some of them by road. But if you're walking along the trail, you come out into a little hamlet somewhere,
right.
Which seems frozen in time. And then the people you meet in these places are really quite unique. And okay, there's an aging population. Many of the younger generation have gone to the big city.
Big city.
But quite a few people are actually coming back. They realize
actually, nowadays in Taiwan, it's quite popular. It's like a lot of young generation. They might start in a big city or maybe a abroad or something like that. And then they came back. And came back is like they're trying to do is to get back to the community.
So
which thing is... To me, I think that's a very good idea.
So they got a different taste of life when they were overseas and they came back
here
and they view Taiwan with an outsider's point of view, maybe.
One thing is like when they study abroad, when they study in the big city, they just realize that, you know, how lucky they are, you know, their family had such a beautiful Hakka culture, you know, back in the hometown, something like that. And secondly, you know, they might bring back like a new knowledge or new like a skill, something like that, to helping the, you say, time still, the kind of Hakka community, you know, can develop something new. Yeah.
Yeah, the Hakkas have always been, I think, very adaptable people. They had to be.
We have to be, yes.
You didn't get the best choice of land when it came to sort of, I wouldn't like to say colonizing, but taking over and making the land of Taiwan profitable from growing things. You were pushed up a little bit into the hills yourselves, and in doing so, the indigenous tribes that were already living there were pushed up even further into the mountains.
Yes.
And so everyone's had to adapt to survive in this scenario.
Yeah. Well, time. You know what? It's very interesting. Depending on what you, what is your perspective, you know, for me, it's like when I was a kid, I was saying that it's not a good idea living, you know, in the mountain. The condition, everything is quite poor, it's not so good. And you kind of like envy the, you know, people live in the town center or something like that. But when you grow up, you realize that that's a different thing, you know, especially nowadays. You might live in the city, but you also feel like this is a modern style jungle, you know?
It's a rat race.
Yeah, so you kind of like a, for myself, it's kind of like a remind me how lucky I am, you know. I used to live in this natural, beautiful.
You can get back to nature. Right. You're lucky you have that opportunity.
Right, especially this time, remember that as a photographer, right? Mm-hmm. Definitely, I believe that when you went to the first one in the Beibu, you see the...
It's like your hometown, Beibu.
Yeah, my hometown. Yeah, you see the tea plantation and landscape. That one is a different thing. And the second, we went to the Miaoli. You see the Lao Guan Dao, which means they had the bamboo tunnel.
It's like a river flowing through the bamboo. Right?
Yeah. And the last one is like we went to the Taichung. We met the guy, is a Wallace. He took us in his hill.
I'm glad we're talking about Wallace.
I like him. Yes. We're standing on the hill and look over, and he started talking about the story and the history. At that point, I was like, all the landscape turned out so differently, right?
Yeah,
so
Wallace,
what do you think?
Wallace is an elder of the indigenous tribe, and he's a historian. He's written about 20 books.
Oh, yeah, more than that.
A lot of them are about sort of fictional accounts of life in his area. And he was looking out across that landscape and revisualizing it as it was when the Hakka settlers first came into his valley, and he pointed down to where they came from, and then his ancestors were pushed up into the hills. So there was a battlefield in some ways back 100 or so years ago. But then we met a few days later Ko Wen, who's this young girl, and she's a she's mixed from a Hakka and an indigenous tribe parents, right?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Saisha.
Saisha
Trial and the Hakka,
Hakka people, and she actually, her project was very interesting because she was with the help of Mr. Doe, her uncle. I don't know if her real uncle or just an elder of the tribe. Anyway, he was helping her to map out the area and find or retain the original tribal names for settlements. Some of those settlements had disappeared. You could see like a wall of stone where a rice terrace used to be, or the remains of an old house, but nobody was living there anymore. But she was, whilst Mr. Doe was still alive and had his memories active in his mind, she was like a...
That's very valuable.
She was doing an anthropological research, really, and mapping it down as an app, actually. So it's all very modern and high tech.
Right.
She's not like mapping written, inscribed family tree on some turtle shell or something. She's actually doing this online as an art project, wasn't it? But she's walking these trails, and she's also getting back to nature, and people would ask her, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You're living a nice life in Taipei. Why do you come out here and suffer the mosquitoes?
But the thing is, like, you know, when he told me that, it's like, look at me right now, you know, I stay in here, you know, every day, you know, for me, it's like no stress, you know, and also with the nature together. So it's like I'm so envy.
Really? You want to get back to your roots too?
Well, it's just, I don't know, I can do it.
Beibu is a
nice
town. Right?
Beibu is nice though. Yeah. But the thing is, like, at this time, you see the landscape, people, and culture.
Yeah.
And you also took a lot of picture about the Hakka cuisine.
Yes.
Yeah. So four different kind.
Yeah.
So tell me about it.
Oh, for me, it's all about the people. Because people actually make the landscape, people make the food, people eat the food, people are working in, you know, as long as you have a landscape there and can place a person in it, either as the main subject or as a feature to give me a sense of scale, then I'm happy. If a landscape doesn't have people in it, I feel that there's something missing somehow. So the good thing is that the Lacanus Salu Trail is still in most areas quite populated.
Oh, yes.
Right? It's not totally forgotten about. Although sections are overgrown and you need a professional guide at the moment to exactly find your way along it. Most parts you can actually do by yourself.
Well, right? I would say that probably like in the past 3 years, the government tried to do it. So ask a lot of different kind of profession, they come in, join this project to try to make it happen. So you see that some of the trail, they can't, even though they have the QR code there. You just scan, so they'll tell you the story.
You can learn about the history.
But some of the, remember we went to that one, it's in Longtan. Remember that they have the, it's because we are exactly in the right season. So we see the tom flower. Wow, the tom blossom, that was so beautiful,
right? Was falling like snow.
Yeah, because
flakes,
I saw you was
it,
like standing there taking the picture all the time. I was like waiting and waiting. You still, I said, okay.
And
one time you was like waiting for another passenger. They went.
Yes, well, see, that's the whole thing. The scene was great, but all it needed was a person to walk through.
Right.
And we couldn't have you because I had you in a lot of shots. So I needed somebody, you know, really, it wasn't a fake picture, you know?
Yeah.
And they were off looking at something else and taking their own pictures or something.
It's too beautiful for them. So attract them. So they was like tapping the picture. I walked by, just like they tried to selfie or like taking picture each other. Like they're having such a fun over there.
Right, it took majors to come into my picture, didn't it? But that's the whole idea. You need the people in the picture to give it some.
Right.
You have to see the joy in their faces, or you know, just the scale of the size of the scenery, and how much of the shot is actually taken up with these tong blossoms. We were lucky. I mean,
they only
fall in May usually.
Normally, it's pretty much like happen in late April to early May or something like that.
We timed that well.
Oh yeah, so we're lucky. Yeah.
Fun fact, Tung Tree Wood's economic value was an important resource in helping many Hakka families. That's the main reason that the Hakka have deep feelings and heartfelt gratitude toward the Tung Tree, the mountains, and nature in general.
But not all of the trail was like that, was it? I remember at some point scrambling. There was Mr. Lee Cha Chi.
I was like, remember we were always talking about that.
How do you say that in Hakka?
In Hakka, okay. I'm going to teach you some Hakka lesson. Okay. Are we there yet?
Are we there yet? Yeah. That's very useful.
Endeosa.
Endeosa.
Domang.
Domang.
Endeosa.
Endeosa.
Domang.
Domang.
Are we there yet?
Endeosa.
Endeosa. Domang.
Domang.
Yes. Mang.
Endeosa, domang.
Domang. Or if, maybe you can cut it short, just
let
me, like I said.
Write that back down again.
Yeah. Domang.
Yeah. I'm going to use this a lot. So domang is like a questioning.
Yeah, it's like a questioning. Are we there yet? Something like that,
yeah. Yeah. Well, no, we were never there yet, were we? No, it's always, no, we've still got more to go. But he's actually a landscape architect. That's his profession. He actually helps design national parks.
Right.
So he was looking at that from a his professional point of view, that section, it wasn't the whole trail, it's just maybe a 15-kilometer section of trail. Took us about 5 hours to walk it, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Hacking through the bamboo with machetes and getting cut up.
You know, somehow, you know, when I just like, I was like hiking with, you know, with him, I just realized that he's like Indiana Jones.
Yeah, right?
We
all tied our headbands on, didn't we? They worked, though, to stop the sweat. But the last time I had a headband was like listening to Bon Jovi in 1986.
Bon Jovi.
It took me back to my youth.
So you can go to Lacanus Trail and singing rock and roll.
Exactly. I relive my past life.
Yeah.
But the nature there was just, I think on that section of the trail, it was quite severe. But in other parts of the trail, it was more like a country park. It was more, we could stroll along without slipping up too much, without getting, bashed and bruised by bamboo shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very pleasant. And you could imagine there maybe taking your family and walking on that section, like in Guangxi, right? Beside the river in Guangxi.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's the one with the QR codes.
Yeah, that one is with the QR code. Mm-hmm.
So it's a short section, and it's obviously like a beginner's stage or just to let you into it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Slowly, but Guangxi itself is an important settlement, right?
There's in Guangxi at that time, I would say there is a in the like a tea industry. It's like a golden tea, this kind of age.
So it's at the end of the trail, really, isn't it? Guangxi is where the tea would come down to.
Right, right.
And then they amassed it there. Isn't there, like, there was a museum there. Was that that place?
Oh, that's, a black tea museum.
Black tea museum, yes. not the Dongfang.
Because nowadays, a lot of people don't know that. Back in like 50 years ago, at that time, Taiwan is the most important, you know,
exporter
for the black tea in the whole world.
They had the stencils up on the wall there of all the places they would, and it was global. You know, you'd stencil on the side of the tea crate.
Yeah, I saw London.
Aden, London, Osaka, all around the world, this tea was sent just from the little town of Guangxi. It's just incredible.
I asked the guy told me that, you know what, they used to be, it's kind of like a play, it's like, for example, it's a whole box, they're going to ship into the London. So that's why they just put the wood. They started use the painting pen. So and they take out the
bowl. Stencil.
So you will see that London, the world, is coming down to the wood.
Onto the wood. Painted onto it.
So that's right.
But the whole industry has just gone now. And the tea plantations themselves have gone back to nature, haven't they? You can't really see much evidence of where those tea plantations were. They're kind of overgrown, or in some cases they've been taken over by, in Miaoli they have strawberry now. Strawberries.
Strawberry everywhere.
Where did that come from? Who came back with that idea? Yeah. They grow these giant strawberries, and probably somebody went to, I don't know, Europe and came back with this idea, okay, guys, we all got to change and grow strawberries.
And you know what? Actually, for me, I was like, it was so interesting because remember we went with Mr. Pong. He told us what that way.
I also see the temples, the shrines, the Bagong.
The Bagong shrine. So you see that whatever the Hakka people, you know, you will find the Bagong, you know, which is the goddess of
God,
land.
Right?
The goddess of land,
of
you
land.
Know. Yeah, that was quite different.
Yeah.
And so we are lucky because nowadays the Bagong, the shrine, is became quite glow. And it's...
Mm. As people get richer, they build more elaborate shrines.
Right.
But with him we found... and this is really getting back to nature.
Yeah.
One of them was just a giant camphor tree, wasn't
it?
I mean, remember how far we had to go up to find that tree?
That one is, to me, is so touching.
Really rare.
Yeah, but it's so touching because you see that when he told me that actually we don't really see the Bagong, but they said because when the tree became bigger and bigger, embraced the Bagong, you know, the inside the tree.
Is the actual statue of the god.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And just...
And it's a massive, that's the biggest living camphor tree that I saw.
Exactly, that's why it's just like when I was standing there, it's just, give me that kind of feeling and the message, just like you mentioned that it's like nowadays, you know, maybe in the past, you know, we might because of land issue, because the business issue, we had it against each other. But at the end, everything is compared together, embraced together. I think the camphor and the Bagong, Hakka and the indigenous culture, you know, at that point, just like everything makes sense to me, you know.
Yeah, the sort of marketing imperative, the economic imperative,
right,
to make a living in this harsh environment of just mountains and narrow, non-navigable valleys. Mm. It forced people, the Haka and the indigenous people, really to work out how to live together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Instead of constantly fighting with each other, it's like, hey, hang on, guys. Maybe we can make some money out of this. And the Haka are pretty industrious, and they had access to the markets.
Right.
And the indigenous people had the skills to know how to grow things.
Right.
It's a match made in heaven, really.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's so, really
that's
cool.
A good thing about the trail. It is one of sort of connection and inclusivity, more than you would think from reading history books, which often just tell you about this conflict between the two different peoples.
Yes.
So, but the reality is not like that at all.
No.
Fun fact, the Hakka people refer to the god of earth as Bagong, which in the Hakka language refers to the older brother of one's grandfather. The name given to the deity shows the Hakka's close feelings towards the god of earth, treating him like a member of the family.
But the other Bagong temples, sorry, by the way, could just be a rock, couldn't it?
I
don't know. Why would they choose a rock, do you think?
That's a part of the like Hakka culture. Mm-hmm. It's like the same thing. It's like, you know, Hakka always moving around. You know, when we're moving around, not just carry our ancestors. The other thing is to carry like our religion. Mm. One of our religions, the most important, is the Bagong.
So you bring this god would come from China originally?
No. The thing we've done is like, okay, when we go there, we were looking for one of the rock, you know, and then we will start to playing the rock and also asking, he said, okay, Bagong, if you're happy with this rock, maybe, you know, you can stay here, something like that.
I see.
Yeah, stuff on that. Everything's stuff on that.
I noticed you were, whenever we went to one of these shrines, you would pray. And I joined in with you actually from time to time to make sure that we could actually photograph there.
Right.
It was just like an insurance policy.
See,
that's
one thing is like, it's very important. You have to like respect. So that's why I always ask the Bagong, I say, first, just like a greeting to the Bagong and tell him that is thank you very much to helping us. And the second part is like, I want Bagong to understand what are we doing right now, and especially for the crazy, you're the photographer. So that's right. Ask him to, you know, just don't mind, you know, we're taking the pictures and like that.
They didn't mind, did they?
Yeah,
it seems that you know how to talk to them. Yeah. Do you think a lot of Hakka people understand this to the degree that you do? Do you think that they are different in that way from other Taiwanese people, that they still understand and respect their ancestors maybe more than?
I would say still, but I'm not quite sure about more. Yeah, it really depends. But along with the trail, because mostly is with Hakka village.
Yeah,
Hakka community.
Oh, 90%, right?
Yeah, 90%. Right. That's why you see this kind of tradition still carry on. Yeah.
For me, that was actually a very unusual side of Taiwan to see.
Yeah.
It's like the whole central western part of Taiwan is Hakka country. It's like a Hakka land. You know, you almost should issue passport or visas to come in and out. It's so different from the rest of Taiwan. And yet, if you look at it visually, it's... there are small details, maybe in architecture, maybe in food, but there's not too much different in the actual faces of the people themselves.
Yeah.
But the jobs that they still do, the connection with the landscape is quite unique.
Right, that's true. Yeah. That's right. Okay, you know what? Right before we say goodbye, you know, I also want to teach you another like a Hakka lesson, because you were saying that first you are the photographer, and second you're taking a lot of beautiful pictures.
That means
every time.
That's an excuse for not being very good at languages, right? You know, Danny, because I don't like talking to people. I just want to take their photographs. Talking is a distraction.
Because I see that you are so professional. you know, you are kind of like focused on what you're trying to do. Yeah. You know. And somehow,
too much sometimes.
I always heard about that. You say, oh, so beautiful, so beautiful, so beautiful. That's why I'm thinking, maybe it's the time for me to teach you the Hakka lesson.
Another one for me to write down.
Beautiful in Hakka.
Okay.
What do you think?
Okay.
Okay, good. Okay, let's go. Beautiful. Dong jiang.
Dong jiang.
Dong jiang.
Dong jiang.
Yeah, dong jiang.
So this It's a tonal language still,
yes.
isn't it? Mm-hmm. How many tones are there in
by the way? I don't know, but more than 10.
More than 10?
Yes, oh, more than God, 10, is... yes. That's the beauty of the Hakka.
Yes.
Yeah. Dong jiang.
Dong jiang.
Dong jiang. Okay, very good.
Do you think people, which is that the Xinju dialect?
This one is a Xinju dialect.
It's your dialect.
Okay, yeah. Maybe we can do another one. It's like a Miaodi dialect, okay? It's like a dong jiang.
Similar. This one.
Similar. Yeah. Huh?
Say again.
Dong jiang.
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 Okay. Remember first one?
First one was the Dong jiang.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. This episode, I actually told you the true Hakka, right? Two lessons. Mm. First one, are we there yet?
Oh, are we there? Oh, my goodness. NDL.
Huh?
NDL jiao. No, NDL
sa. NDL sa.
NDL sa.
Dong mang,
endiao sa, dong mang.
Are we there yet?
I know. We know.
Second one is so beautiful. Dong jiang,
dong jiang,
dong jiang,
dong jiang,
dong jiang,
dong jiang.
Very good.
In the central. Oh, you're very polite. Yeah. Anyway, I'd like to thank everyone for listening in on this. I hope you learned something about the secrets of the Lacanoose Trail on this podcast.
Yes. Bye bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Secrets of the Lac Nu Salut Trail podcast.